Okay, so we have our first test Wednesday here during regular class time. Just to remind you, you can bring a 3 inch by 5 inch index card with anything you want written on either side. And because once a physics 113 student I knew showed up with they have an 8.5 by 11 inch sheet of paper, more formulas, showed up with the paper with flaps taped to it and looked at me funny when I objected. So I always have to specify that you cannot have this thing topologically enhanced. We have to have just the surface area that comes on the card. And if you could bring a calculator with powers of 10. And I can't tell you anything else about the exam because I haven't made it out yet. So do you have any questions? Yeah. Yeah, I haven't made it out yet, and it's not going to be formula heavy. Does that mean no formulas? I mean, I don't know, but I'll put whatever. I mean, it's not a memorization course. That's partly why I do that. So, but if I give a problem where I think V equals lambda nu is a useful formula for you to have, I'll write it on the sheet and put it at the end of the exam. Given that I haven't made the exam out, and if I were to forget to do that and you need one during the exam, you just ask me and I'll write it on the board. So, yep.
How long did we wait in the textbook in comparison to the lectures?
I mean, I don't know. I've been trying to pick textbook material that more or less coincides with the kind of stuff we're talking about in class. And it is true that I don't... Actually, in this course in particular, because it's a fairly unconventional course, but even in a very conventional course, I tend to make my lectures up without looking at the textbook that you're using. And I've actually known students who, of course, hate that because they like them to be lockstep, but I actually look at that as a way of providing a different sort of complementary depth. I mean, reading is an important part of the class, so I'm actually... I mean, I can't say that I'm going to go looking through the textbook and find something that I specifically didn't talk about in class and put it on the test. That I won't do. Having said that, I might put something on the class about, I mean, on the test on other stuff that we've read or did in recitation. So something like, I mean, you guys did some stuff on nature of science that we talked about some in class, but not so much. We did a number of articles on the computational multiverse, which really we could talk about in here, but it is just sort of an aside thing. So all of that's sort of fair game. I mean, there's an article about Copernicus, which I thought was a fun article. Would I go through there and memorize dates and all that? No, but there was a point to that article, which was a general theme, and there were a couple of points that probably are worth knowing about. I mean, so was that evasive enough for you? I'm not really trying to evade. I don't really know. I mean, that's a hard one to answer. I don't really have intent to bias it seriously one way or I mean. Yeah, I don't know yet. I have to sit down and make the test out, so it's hard to know. Yeah, I don't have good advice for that, so sorry. Anything else about the test you're on your mind? Anybody got anything that they've been thinking about in preparation that they want to ask? I usually try to have an opportunity for question and answers the day before test, but I just looked at my calendar and I don't think I can do that tomorrow, so I apologize for that. Try to do it for the second test. But if something comes up during your studies, you have a question about something, don't hesitate to email and I'll see if I can answer it. And if it's something that I might, that other people might find useful, I'll sanitize it, so I'll remove your name, but I can broadcast the answer to everybody. And I will try to do that. Yep.
To what extent should we use the recitation materials?
My intent was to, if I were to ask anything analytical, to have it coming, that something pretty similar to what you've done in recitation. So the intent with recitation was to help with a lot of exam preparedness and things like that. So I'll probably, to the extent that the exam might change a little relative to the last time I taught the class, or my intent was to pull it a bit more from what was discussed in recitation. Yeah. The K?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's not, I couldn't really find that within the book.
Okay. Yeah, so Coulomb's Law. The force between two charged particles, Q1 and Q2, goes as a constant times Q1 times Q2 over R squared. And hopefully you're not looking at a book that writes it in this other form, but I'm going to write it just so that if you do see it this way, you have seen it. Sometimes this is written as 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught, Q1, Q2 over R squared. K and this are really the same number. It's just rewriting it. Hopefully you're not seeing, if you're looking at a book where you're seeing it like this, you're way beyond what we're wanting to do in here. Was that the K?
The K shows up when I looked through a couple of websites just to talk about it, but in the book in chapter 8 on page 65 lists the formula, and F is proportional to Q1 times Q2 over D2, and that's
over D squared.
D squared.
Yeah. Right, okay. So F is proportional to Q1, Q2 over D squared. If I have a Q1 here and a Q2 there and the distance between them is D, so the fact that they write a D and I put an R is just notation. I'm calling the distance between the charges R and they call it D. Okay? So that's the same thing. This D and that R would be exactly the same thing. Here, this is a proportionality, and if you want to put an equals, then you have to put in a proportionality constant, which is what K is. And so K is just a number, and I would give you that number on a test, or it would be on, you know, on the sheet, or you can ask for it. It physically, what it does is, once you select what units you're going to measure your charge distance and force in, then this is a number that makes all of that work. And once you've got that, a way to think about it is, if K is really, really big, then it's a strong force, and if it's really small, it's sort of a weak force, so it sort of sets the scale.
And that would make sense, because again, in the book here, it says that F is 9 times 10 to the 9th.
That K is 9 times 10 to the 9th, right, yeah. Yeah, so if you're in newtons and coulombs and meters, then K is 9 times 10 to the 9th, or something like that. Yeah, which I would give you, and I'd have to specify the units and stuff if I did that.
Do we have recitation this week?
Yes. I think so. But the new week's recitation starts Wednesday, right? So the Monday recitation still is sort of last week's recitation. If the cycle's what I think it is.
So is that always like that? So like the Wednesday will be the first like new recitation?
Hasn't it been that way all semester?
I only go to Friday.
I think it has been.
Oh, okay.
And that just had to do with a fluke, as I think it was Martin Luther King Day or something that was right at the start, so we had to start the first one on Wednesday. Anything else? Yep. Okay. So it's the proper frame bit that's confusing, I would guess.
Yeah.
Oops. Okay, so for time dilation, or if you're dealing with a time thing, the time of an event is measured in one reference frame is equal to the time of an event measured in some other reference frame. I'll just call it the prime frame. But they're related by this quantity gamma, this 1 over the square root of 1 minus the quantity v over c squared. And the question is, which side does the gamma go on, and which is prime and which is unprime? So the way to think about it is the following, that we have time dilation. So what that means, there's one special frame. And the special frame is the one where the event is at rest. So if it's the lifetime of a bug, it would be the reference frame where that bug is at rest. If it's, I don't know, the time for water to boil out of a pot, it would be where that pot is at rest. So that would be the special frame, which is called the proper frame. And if you can just remember time dilation, that means time gets longer in any frame other than this, which means the proper frame is always going to have the shortest time. And so that tells you which side to put the gamma on. If you have an event where there's a bug on a spaceship and you're asking something about the lifetime of the bug, then the spaceship is the proper frame. And if I call this the prime frame, then that's the one that has the shortest time. And gamma is always greater than 1, which means gamma would have to go on the side with the prime. And that's sort of the thinking you have to go through. And I don't know how to make it simpler than that, in the sense that there is the special frame, and you have to know that the special frame is the shortest time. So in every problem, you have to look at it, and if it's asking about a relationship of time between one frame and another, you have to identify which is the frame where the event is at rest. And that's the one where the time will be the shortest. And it will be longer in all the other frames, which means you just have to multiply by gamma, which is always greater than 1, to get that. Yeah.
So, like, if someone goes into space, and we perceive it, on Earth as them being gone for 80 years, but they only age 10 years, then their perception is this special frame.
I have to really look at the exact wording of the problem or whatever. So if we think about this, if you are asking how much time passes elsewhere and someone's on a spaceship and 10 years pass on the spaceship and that's the number you're given, right, then that is a number for the person on the spaceship at rest with the spaceship. So yes, the time would be longer in any other reference frame. So
that would be like special. That's
the proper frame.
With the train example, when the person's on the train would be the special frame.
Right.
Okay.
Because the event is happening on the frame, on the train. So in length contraction, it's the same thing, except it's length contraction, which means I can't talk and actually write and spell correctly all at the same time. What that means is that in the special frame, whatever you're measuring lengthwise is longest along the direction of motion in the proper frame. So if you're measuring the length of a meter stick, it is measured to be 1 meter in its rest frame. And it will be measured to be shorter if it's in any other reference frame. So if the meter stick is on a spaceship zooming by, if you're on the spaceship, it looks like 1 meter. But if you're perceiving it from any other reference frame, it will look much shorter. Yep.
So it's the same formula then?
It's the same formula except for T's, you put L's. And the gamma, there's no, which side you put the gamma on, I mean, don't fall into a trap. I don't remember what convention's been used in your textbook or the problems, but very often there'll be some example problem that might distinguish the two reference frames using some prime. And there's a trap that many students will fall into, which is to associate the gamma with the prime, and the prime is what they perceive as the moving frame or something like that. You're definitely just jumped over the cliff if you're thinking that way, because there's nothing special about what's prime or not prime. What's special is which one's the proper frame and where does the gamma go with respect to that. So
the gamma always goes with the one that's at rest.
For time dilation, the gamma always goes with the one that is at rest because the time gets bigger in the other frame and gamma is always greater than one. For length contraction, it's the other way around because whatever it is gets shorter in any other reference frame. Okay, so the way I've written time dilation, this is the proper frame. Because time is the shortest in that frame. For length contraction, if this is the proper frame, so whatever it is you're measuring is at rest in that frame, the gamma goes on the other side because this is the shortest. And gamma is greater than one. I'm sorry, this is the longest. Gamma is greater than one. I'm sorry?
Will we be giving gamma if we need it?
Yeah, I'll give you gamma if you need it. And yeah, I mean, I guess it's fair. I might ask something like this, but it's not going to be a huge part of the test because that's starting to, I mean, it's a bit of a twisted analytical stuff, yeah.
I'm sorry, I'm just confused. You said the special frame is the shortest, but time is always...
No, it's length contraction. So in the special frame, wherever something is at rest, the proper frame, it will be longest, measured longest. And if you measure it from any other reference frame, you'll see it to be shorter. Oh, for time, it's the other way around. Time is the shortest in the proper frame. They're backwards from each other, so it's confusing. Yeah. There's only one special frame. There's only one frame of reference where an object or an event is at rest. In any other frame of reference, you'll be moving with respect to that. So that's the one we call the proper frame. Okay, now I have to ask one of those, I guess.
No,
I don't. Okay.
Can you do like an example of it?
Can you just do the recitation question?
Sure. Read it for me. Okay, so Velma passes Earth at 0.95C. She watches a video program that runs 1 hour. All right. So here's Velma, here's Earth. And she's watching a program in the spaceship. So at 0.95C, I believe gamma is equal to 3.2. Let's assume that that's true. Okay. So she moves past Earth at a speed of 0.95C. She watches a video program that takes 1 hour to her perception on the spacecraft. So the proper time is going to be 1 hour in Velma's frame of reference, because that's where she's watching the show. So how long does the program run as measured by an Earth-based observer? Okay, so Velma is in the proper frame. We have time dilation, which means in any other reference frame, it's going to seem to take longer. So the gamma is greater than 1, so it has to multiply Velma's time. So the time measured on Earth will be 3.2 hours. It would be the 1 hour times the gamma of 3.2. Yes?
Yeah, what's gamma, the units for gamma?
It's unitless. It's just a... It's.
So whether you're doing...
Gamma is 1 over the square root of 1 minus V over C quantity squared. So the units of V, these are both speeds, so the units here cancel out and everything else is unitless, so it's just a scale factor. Yep.
How did you get the value?
Because I've done too many of these problems. I would give it to you. I'm not going to make you calculate that out all day. The way I would take the 0.95C, 0.95C goes right here. And so that means 0.95C over C becomes 0.95 squared, and 1 minus 0.95 squared, square root of that, and then invert it, you get the 3.2. Yeah, I'm not going to drag you through that.
So, I'm sorry, gamma is just 3.2?
Yeah.
Oh,
wait. I didn't give it to you in recitation, because I'm happy to drag you through the mud a little bit in recitation. But on an exam, I'd give it to you. And if I forget to, you can ask for it. Yep?
This is just a quick question. I remember doing this problem presentation and getting some answer. But my question is, the formula we have for gamma, is there a name for that? Or is it just gamma?
This formula? I would just call it the formula for gamma. I don't think it has a special name. Gamma is the scale factor that relates these times and distances in relativity. Yeah. There's. Yeah.
Where does the 0.95C come into this problem?
Right here. That, if you were to calculate, the gamma is the thing that gives you this fact that gives you the degree to which the time changes. So, you have to calculate gamma, and I just said I would give it to you, but this 0.95C goes right here, and then when you evaluate this, that's gamma, so that gives you 3.2.
Oh.
So if this were 0.99C, then this number becomes a bit bigger, 1 minus that number becomes something smaller, 1 over that becomes a much bigger number, and gamma becomes very big. So if the relative speed between the frames is really big, close to C, then this factor becomes huge, and the difference in time becomes very big. If this factor is very small compared to the speed of light, then this number is effectively zero, and 1 over the square root of 1 is just 1, and so there's no difference in the time. Yeah.
When you put C down on the problem, is that going to be in kilometers per second?
Yeah, if you need to actually calculate something, I'll give it to you. And generally, I would use 3 × 10⁸ meters per second. Yeah, that would be the number I would start from. Now, if I gave you something in some other units, I would give you C in those units. Yep.
In class, we got another equation.
Right.
You
mean the Lorentz transformations, this x, or Lorentz current? You mean the length contraction? Do you mean the one with the L's, or do you mean one that looks like this?
No.
Something like that. I'm not gonna have you use these things.
Is LM equals LR over gamma?
Okay, so that would be a length contraction problem, which is the... Right now I'm doing time, but I could have done the same problem here, but instead of watching a video, let's say she was measuring the length of a shoe. And so then it would be just like what we did, except the gamma would go on the other side.
So I guess we just...
Okay, so just to complete this, since we started it, in the recitation there was another question, which was, Velma passes Earth at a speed of 0.95c. On Earth, a person watches a video program that runs 1 hour. How long does the program run as measured by Velma? So Velma's up here and is zooming past Earth. And now somebody down here watches the TV and they have a 1 hour show. So in this case, the proper time is on Earth and not Velma's frame of reference. So in this case, T, Velma, T, Earth, this is 1 hour, and now that's the proper frame, so the gamma goes over here, which means T, Velma is equal to 3.2 hours. So it's the same problem, but I'm just looking at it from the other point of view. So then the follow-up question is, how does this all make sense? Because if Velma's watching a TV show on Earth, it looks like it's 3.2 times longer. If you're watching a TV show on Earth, if you're looking at it from the spaceship, it looks like it's 3.2 times longer. Can you make sense of your answers to the last two questions? What I have written here is no. So, what do you does this make sense to you? What do you think?
It depends on the frame of reference, and so whether or not you're actually moving, if something appears to be moving very quickly, it will appear to take
off. Yeah, it does depend on the frame of reference. I mean, they're both right. There's nothing tricky about these. These are both correct calculations. But what you're asking in each case is to take something measured in one frame of reference and translate it to the other frame of reference. And this is how they transform. There are two different things. One of them is a TV show being watched up here, and the other is a TV show being watched down there. Where things get weird is when you're translating what happens here to there or what happens here to there. And in that translation, you have time dilation going both directions. So it's sort of strange.
Isn't that just also just because, like, the relative motion of the Earth, the orbit, the rotation around the Sun, all the different movements.
Well, the Earth could be going straight, and it would still be the same thing. It's just, it's all point of view, right? If I'm on the spaceship, I'm not moving. Earth is zipping past. So I see Earth is moving. So it's all my point of view. So if I now ask, what do I see if something happens on Earth? It has the same kind of factor as it does if I'm sitting on Earth and I see the spaceship going. That's only dependent on your point of view. Your relative point of view. It's weird stuff. Okay, so anyway, that question was meant to get you talking about that.
Weren't there also cases where that it wasn't just like 3.2 both ways? Like if you,
well, if you tie them together, okay, so if you have, in the twin paradox, for example, if you have two twins, yeah, and you separate them and one gets on a spaceship and goes flying off and come back, now you've got a different problem because you involve accelerating reference frames. You can't start together and then have one of them reach a constant speed with respect to the other without acceleration, and that actually breaks the symmetry between the two of them, and it actually turns it into a general relativity problem, which we're not really talking about. It's more, there are answers, and it does happen. So if you, in fact, you did that, the person who accelerates and goes off actually is the one who would come back younger. So that's a problem that people have solved, but it's not the one we're looking at. Yeah?
So, in an example like this where we're like watching a movie, the proper frame will always be where the movie's watched?
Yeah, where the event is at rest.
Okay, where the event is at rest.
Yeah. I mean, so the other way I would ask that is, suppose Velma watches a TV show and some astronomer on Earth sees that show to take 1 hour. Now I've given you the time on the other side. I didn't give you the proper time. I gave you the time in the other reference frame, right? Because she's watching it in the spaceship. So there, I could give you either time. That's why thinking your way through it and knowing which side to put the gamma on is what's the important. Yeah.
This might sound kind of like a stupid question, but like the whole thing about length contraction and how it's, I guess all length is just a matter, all dimensions are just a matter of perception. Well, like if you had a train moving, like, I don't know, like 0.9 the speed of light, and it's contracted until, let's say it's normally like 50 feet and it's contracted to like 10 feet, could I like throw something like that would that's like 10 feet wide and catch it in that 10? Do you see what I'm saying? Like if it's actually contracting, like could you fit it in something that's like that only would, you know, if I had a giant 10 foot long box, could I drop it on the train and like capture the train even though it's like 50 feet if it was...
Right, so this is the ladder and the barn,
yeah,
problem. Yeah, I mean we talked about this ladder and barn at one point where the barn is too short for the ladder to fit in, so the farmer's son runs with the ladder really fast, and because of that, if you're standing off to the side, you see the barn here, and the ladder is now length contracted. So in principle, it can fit in the barn with both doors closed. And by that I mean both doors are closed simultaneously in your reference frame, right? Now, the paradox comes in when you look at it from the point of view of the guy running with the ladder. Now, the barn is what's moving. Yeah. If you're running with the ladder, your ladder hasn't changed its length. The barn gets shorter. So there's no way you're going to fit it in and close both doors simultaneously in your reference frame.
Okay, so it kind of works then.
How does this work? Yeah. Okay, and the way in which this works is that, how do you know when the ladder is in the barn? You know it's in the barn when you have this door and that door closed in your reference frame. So the farmer can have that very momentarily, you know, for this short moment that the ladder is passing through the barn, slams the door shut. And so the farmer perceives the doors to be shut at the same time. But if you go and you look at the Lorentz transformation, so the more complex form that I showed to you where the time and the position depend, in one reference frame, depend on the time and the position in the other reference frame. So we haven't done problems that involve that. But what it meant was that because these two doors are at different locations in the runner's reference frame, the fact that they're closed at the same time in the farmer's reference frame means they cannot be closed at the same time in the runner's reference frame. So what the runner would actually see is this door closed as they're coming in, and then as they move further, this door closes because they didn't close simultaneously. So in fact, the ladder is sticking out one side and then sticking out the other side from the point of view. So physics works. The same thing can happen, but simultaneity changes because you have these two events, the two doors closing at different locations. So I'm not going to ask anything like that on a test. That was for fun. Yes?
But if they close at the same time from the reference frame of the observer, isn't there an objective same time?
No. That's the thing. Simultaneity goes out the window with relativity.
But even from the
because space and time get mixed up. So that's why we can't even talk about space and time independently, really, since the day's relativity was invented. We can really only talk about space-time. It only makes sense to talk about them having this sort of this immutable independent reality if you're not allowing things to happen at large fractions of the speed of light, relatively speaking.
And the Lorentz transformation explains this paradox.
Yeah, Lorentz transformation shows how these ideas change, the idea how simultaneity changes.
But for the reference frame of the person running with the ladder, isn't there an objective simultaneity for the both doors closed?
Right, but for them, sure, there would be, but the farmer wouldn't see that. The farmer wouldn't see those two simultaneous then. Something, okay. Things that are simultaneous but at different places in one reference frame,
yeah,
will not be simultaneous in any other reference frame.
So even though things actually do contract at high speeds, they don't actually, you can't actually fit them into smaller things because...
Well, you can, but it depends on your point of view.
But how could fitting it into the barn be like someone's point of view?
What do you mean when you say fit it in? You mean
closed,
both doors closed
and this
at the same time where you're concerned. So yes, there would be only one reference frame where you could do that. Because the other reference frame, I couldn't get the ladder in with both doors closed.
It's like, for some reason, this is harder for me to like understand. I can understand the time being dilated, but I just like the ending. So like from the reference frame of the farmer, like it just, what, the doors would, they would close and the the ladder would be what, breaking out of the doors? I don't really like...
Yeah. I mean, if the farmer, as it comes in, if the farmer did this, sure, that ladder's going to go blasting through the other door. Yeah.
It would go blasting through the other door if you're from the reference frame.
Like, that wouldn't actually happen.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead. Is there, did you have a question specific you wanted?
No, not yet.
Oh, okay. Yep.
I had a question from the sample exam you sent us.
The
problem is like kind of the same as this. Just like it's problem 12 on the sample exam, and it's about like the football field, and then it says the football field is 100 yards long, which I'm assuming would be gamma. Is that right?
Well, 100 yards is a distance, right? That's not gamma.
You'd say it's like explicitly like gamma is...
I don't know what I did for that test.
It says a spaceship passes a football field lengthwise at 0.95 C. You're sitting in the stance of the football field as the spaceship zips by. You know the football field is 100 yards long, which is 94 meters, in the direction that the spaceship travels. And then there are three questions, and I'm just confused, like, the difference between two of them. Because one of them says, how long does the football field appear to the spaceship pilot? And the other one says, how long does it take the spaceship to traverse the field according to the point of view of the spaceship pilot?
Okay, so yeah, so I would I was expecting a little more analytically probably for that than I think I will be for you guys, because I'm trying to make this more reading oriented. But so one of those is a length contraction problem, and I guess I was expecting them to calculate gamma. So I would probably give you gamma, all right, and then the 100-yard field is in the proper frame on the ground.
Okay.
And the spaceship's going by, and because this is the proper frame, you'll have length contraction. The spaceship will see it shorter by a factor of gamma.
Right.
So if it were 0.98C, for example, gamma is a factor of 5. So on the spaceship, it actually looked like it was only 20 yards long.
Okay.
Everything would look compressed in that direction. Very strange business. Then, so now they would see themselves. They know they're moving at 0.98 times C. And they see this traversing, they see it traversing only 20 yards. So distance is equal to velocity times time. So you would put the distance of 20 yards is equal to 0.95 times c times the time, and be an enormously short time because speed of light is very big. But that's an example where I was tweaking things and making it a little bit harder. And I certainly, at this stage, having not been out of the test, can't promise that I won't pull some stunt like that on you, but, you know, I'm going to try not to. And if I do, I pull it on everybody at once, so. Yep?
Can we review the problem with the flash strobe and dropping the pool ball? We tried doing it in class and it didn't work.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, I was thinking maybe you were doing some problem.
Okay, that I'd be unlikely to ask you something like that on a test. But the way that that works is if you drop something, it's moving slowly at first. There's a force on it. It has a mass, force of gravity. It's moving slowly at first, then it picks up speed. And if you take a picture of it with a fixed time, so every tenth of a second or something. So initially it will look like this, and then because it hasn't gone very far, its speed is small. A tenth of a second later it's here, then a tenth of a second later it's here, but note this distance is bigger than that distance, because so distance 2 is bigger than distance 1 because it's moving faster during the second tenth of a second. And then in the third tenth of a second, it's moving even faster. And in the fourth tenth of a second, it's moving even faster. So what you can do is you can measure this distance, and you can estimate the speed during this first bit to be the distance. Divided by the time, which is the 0.1 second. And then you can do the same thing, for example, here. V2 is equal to the distance D2 divided by the time. And then acceleration is the change in the velocity with respect to time. So in a period of 1/10 of a second, you have a change in velocity, which is V2 minus V1 over the amount of time. And this is approximately the acceleration. So that's sort of the game that you play. And you can do that. You'll actually do a better job if you let it go down further and you have bigger distances. And so part of what I was hoping to have you thinking about and doing in recitation is the actual process of going and making this measurement means you have to decide things like, from what point on the ball do I make the measurement? And the scale over here is a little fuzzy, so you know, you have to make judgment calls as to where the ball is. So you're making these approximations, which means these numbers are not perfect. So there's some inherent error in the acceleration you figure out. And so I wanted you to sort of experience that and realize that there's fuzziness in trying to figure this out. But hopefully to a lesser extent, that's true in any scientific measurement that's made, and that's sort of what we mean when we talk about errors in scientific measurements. So that was the goal of that. Okay. I hope that worked in some of your sections. No? Yes?
The only way it didn't really seem to work is just certain lengths were like the same. We measured them as the same.
Okay.
So like from 2 to 3 and 3 to 4, like they were.
Oh, that may be because it hasn't moved very far, and probably the difference in the distance was small compared to your ability to measure these distances. So probably if I were doing this, I would probably measure one of these, and I'd measure one down here, and then use the appropriate time.
Is it possible that the photos being taken were not being consistently taken at the same?
It's certainly possible, but probably on the scale of your ability to measure these lengths, the timing was probably pretty good.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a decent camera flash that I was using. Yeah. No, that's we're headed that direction.
Is that for the next one?
Yeah. I mean, we did actually look at a little double slit stuff with waves, but that was more just trying to understand what interference was. So we're actually going to do a lot more with that very soon when we get to nature quantum mechanics. Yep. Well, you want to get change in V here to get the acceleration. So you do need to measure how you need to know that it's going slower up here than it is down here, because that's what gives you a measure of the acceleration. So if you just calculate its average speed over the entire thing, you won't really have an acceleration.
So how would you do it if you wanted more than that?
I mean, you can measure the difference in speeds here to get the acceleration. You can do the same here. You can do the same here, the same here, the same here. And because the force is the same, the acceleration that you measure should be the same all the way down, actually, because it's constant. So you won't get the same value, in part because it's much harder to get a decent measurement up here where the distances are short. Yep.
Are all the lecture slides and audio files?
All of the lecture slides relevant for the exam are up, and I think there may be 1 or 2 days where, for some technical reason, I didn't get an audio file up. In one case, I simply left my recorder at home. Yeah?
Are the readings for this week going to be on an exam?
No. Anything else? Yep.
In Appendix A and B in the book, you listed out the numerous types of multiverse systems.
Yep.
Do we need to memorize those?
Nope. No, I wouldn't do that. I was just giving you that to sort of give you a preview of the kinds of things we're going to talk about. And at the end of the course, that's something you can look back at and see how they all fit together. That's the hope. That's a little hard for me to, I mean, I've tried to have the stuff that I assign in the book to sort of coincide roughly with what we're talking about in the lectures. So in terms of the kinds of questions I ask, I've tried to do that in recitation. So I don't know. Okay. All right, so if you have other questions as you start studying and stuff and you want to email them, I'll try to get to them. And okay. Okay. So last time we did this cool demo where you have these gratings. Here they're pictured as prisms. They basically both do the same thing. They take light and split it into different frequencies. If you've ever actually taken a DVD or a CD and turned it upside down, and sometimes you'll notice little rainbow-like colors, that's because the thing is made of lots of fine lines of things. It's actually very similar to a grating, which you used last time. So it is splitting the light into its different frequency color, different colors. So last time we saw that if we took white light and put it through a grating, or in this case a prism, and split it into its component colors, what we saw was a smooth gradation of colors from, you know, deep red all the way to deep purple, so the nice colors of the rainbow. That's true if you have a source that is a broadband source, like an incandescent light. And what I mean by broadband, meaning it's actually giving off all these different colors. If we were to try to really understand the nature of matter, we can do that by taking bits of matter that are all of one type, or particular atoms or elements, so hydrogen, or argon, or carbon, or something like that, neon. And if we do that, and we make a particular type of gas so that only that atom is emitting the light, then what we find, in fact, is that we don't see this broad spectrum. We see only particular colors, which of course you can't see on this drawing right now, but you would see only very particular colors, and we call that an emission spectrum. So it's the light that's emitted by the atom. So here you can see a bit better what's going on. So if we have an incandescent light that sends out light of all different frequencies, and you split it and you look at it, you'll basically see this smooth spectrum of color, and these dots are just a graphical issue here, but that's meant to be a smooth spectrum of color. If we have a hot gas and it's emitting light, then it will emit light, if this is a single type of atom, it will emit light only at very particular colors or frequencies, and that will always be true for that atom. It will be those particular colors. If we were to take the same atom, same gas, and now instead of heating it up so that it emits light, let's suppose we let it be cold and we have a white light source behind it, then this gas will absorb light at the exact same frequencies where it would emit light if we heated it up. So the atom has its way of emitting or absorbing light, but only in very particular frequencies. So, and then, I don't know, you can't really see it well on this reproduction, but this would be for white light. This would be the emission spectrum, so you have that gradation of color from deep red to deep purple. This would be for mercury, and you see some particular lines. Here's sodium, and you see different lines. These actually don't line up. This is helium, and there's a line here and a line here, and I don't know, this is too dim to actually see in this particular reproduction, but these are things that you saw with the gratings. And the thing is, all of these atomic elements absorb or emit light at a different set of discrete frequencies, so it's very much like a fingerprint. Okay, you can identify what atoms are in a substance by simply looking at the spectra that are coming out.
You said, is light only emitted from a gas? Is that the only time it becomes an emission? It becomes emissions instead of absorption lines. I thought you said that.
Typically, to create a lamp that works in the lab, typically you have a gas. Yeah, you excite the gas, but no, you can have substances and heat them up so that they glow. But often,
well, I just thought, like, I don't know what it was. This, what produces an emission line spectrum as opposed to an absorption line spectrum? Is that just
okay? We'll get there. Give me a minute. All right. So, in order to try to understand the nature of this emission, this discrete emission and absorption of light by atoms, so we say these particular lines, we call it discrete spectra. This guy Niels Bohr, in 1913, 1912, came up with a model of the atom, which conceptually is really very similar to the modern model of the atom. So it's worth spending a little bit of time on it. In this model, he said a few things. One, he said, is that all the positive charge in the atom is located in a small little bit at the center of the atom, which in and of itself makes little sense, but around 1909-ish, in a lab in England, they had done experiments sending little particles through thin gold foils, and by the way in which they were deflected, they could tell that all the positive charge had to be concentrated in small bits. So that's called the nuclear model of the atom, and we'll talk more about that before long, but for now let's just assume it's a given. So we have a positive nucleus, and then for simplicity, because the mechanics of circular orbits are pretty simple, Bohr said let's have the electrons orbit in circles. So what happens, you have positive here and you have a negative electron here or here or here, and because the positive is pulling on the negative, there's an attraction there. If the electron is moving fast, it can literally just move in a circle, an orbit, about the positive nucleus. And one can actually solve the velocity of the electron or get its energy at a given radius. And for different radii, it's going to actually have a different velocity or a different energy. And so then Bohr basically also made an assumption, and he made this assumption because of the discrete nature of atomic spectra. He said, if we allow all of these orbits to exist, then the atom's going to absorb and emit light at all different colors, and I'll explain that in a minute. But if I only allow, if I want to explain discrete spectra, one way to do that would be to assume that only very particular orbits happen to exist stably in the atom, and that each of these orbits, the electron has a very particular energy, which one can actually calculate because it's on a circular orbit, and we know the force of Coulomb's force between them. So it's a calculable number. But what that means is this: an electron in this circle has one energy, an electron in this circle has a different energy. In fact, the electron up here has more energy than the electron here does. So the atom absorbs light by absorbing a photon that has exactly the difference in energy between this orbital and that orbital. And so if there's an electron in this orbital and there's not one here, then light of an energy, E equals H nu, so light of a very particular color, that is, has the energy, the packet of energy, the photon, has exactly the energy difference between these two orbitals, the electron can absorb the light and go up one orbital. Yeah?
If there are more than two electrons orbiting.
Yeah.
And two differences are the same, two separate differences are the same. Or is that possible, first of all, that, like, say there were eight orbiting electrons and the difference between two separate sets was the same energy.
Okay.
What would happen in terms of absorption?
Yeah, I'm not sure I have exactly the picture you're trying to paint, but if you have orbitals that are the same distance apart and a stream of photons are coming through, you could have two transitions happening. And sometimes you can actually have the difference here be exactly equal to two photons, and it can actually absorb two photons at one time and jump up. I mean, there are some weird things that can happen, but let's not worry about it too much. Okay, so nuclear atom, they move in circles, particular discrete orbits, and the force that holds them in is the electric force. And so with this picture, you might ask, why only particular discrete orbits? And Bohr had a way of calculating it that we're not going to go through, but it was a bit ad hoc. I mean, it sort of looked like it was, and it was, and that's okay because he had an actual aim. His aim was to try to explain discrete spectra. About 10 years later, or a little bit more, when de Broglie came up with the idea that matter had wave-like characteristics, there was some motivation for this discrete orbitals. And so a way to think about that motivation is, if you recall the standing waves on the string, imagine taking this and turning it in a circle. So in a given length of string, okay, only a certain wavelengths of vibration will resonate, where it will interfere constructively so that you get this nice sort of pattern. So if you recall, for a given length, you know, you'll get a pattern like this, and then you'll get one with a node here, and then you'll get one with a node here and a node here. So they're very particular wavelengths that will actually work. So you can imagine taking this and turning it in a circle. And so here would be one where basically, as the wave goes around, it adds onto itself. It's constructive interference. Here's one where you would have destructive interference. So this wave will not propagate on this sort of string, circle string, and this wave will be stable. So a way to think about that is that for electrons of a certain energy, they will only exist at certain radii. So that's a way of sort of motivating the discrete nature. So from the point of view of de Broglie, basically you're saying orbits happen where the electron's wave can constructively interfere with itself, I guess, and that only happens in discrete places. So there's a way to think your way through the through this. And you end up with, for a given atom, there are a series of energy levels that we typically draw in terms of lowest energy here and then higher energy as you go up. And it turns out that the radius is increasing typically as you go up in energy. And so in a particular, in fact, in the hydrogen atom, here's the lowest energy state, which is often called the ground state for atoms. And this would be the first excited energy state. Here'd be the next. Here's the next. And they get closer and closer together as you go up in energy. And so if you now look at an absorption spectrum, so I put a white light behind hydrogen gas, for example, and I then look at what I see, the colors, this is sort of not a very nice reproduction color-wise, but what you would see is that particular frequencies are absorbed, and those particular frequencies that are absorbed would correspond to the energy differences between these different levels. So you could have cases where an electron is down here and it jumps up to here, and that's one particular energy difference. It absorbs a photon of a particular color. It could jump up to here. That's a photon of a different color because the energy difference between these two is different from here. And then you'd have that and then that one. And the same, you could have transitions. If an electron were here, you could have transitions up to those states. Yeah.
What characteristic of the atom dictates the energy change? Is the difference in distance between orbitals?
Yeah, so depending on the charge I have for the nucleus. That actually determines it.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's why the chemical characteristics, if I change the charge in the nucleus, I actually change the type of atom I have. That's what determines how the electrons orbit the nucleus. Yes?
This might be a silly question, but just for context, I'm wondering if the idea of discrete orbitals is what is the foundation for with geometry in time stream? Or that has nothing to do with it?
No, it has everything to do with it. Okay. Yeah, and in fact, we're going to get there shortly. I'm not going to beat you over the head with chemistry, but yeah, absolutely does. All of chemistry follows from this, because chemistry is nothing but rearrangements of electrons. So it all the chemical characteristics of a particular atom are completely determined by the number of positive charges in that nucleus, because that determines the shell structure of the electrons, and it's adjusting those and how those interact that determines chemistry. So
this is what we use for warm up.
Schrodinger's, yeah, we're going to look, well, I'm about to show you the full-blown quantum mechanical solutions in a minute, so maybe that'll make a bell ring, because that's the real atom. This is, I consider this is a good intuitive picture of how atoms actually work. Okay, and then we're going to look at how they really are, but intuitively, I mean, I let my intuition go with the Bohr model often, and it's only if you're doing sophisticated organic stuff that you need to worry too much about the more complex. Well, okay, anybody over in Hutch needs to worry about the more complicated stuff, but I need to be careful. Okay, so discrete spectra. So I could ask a question, for example, if I had an atom that just happened to have four energy levels, how many spectral lines would I have? How many?
Six.
Yep, because you have one here that can go to there, there's one. One here that could go to there, that's two. One here that can go all the way up, that's three. You could start here, that's four. Five, or you could start here, that's six. Six independent. So what that means is, in this particular atom, if you were to heat it up, you would see six discrete colors coming off. Okay? And the colors would, of course, you, from those, you could actually decode the differences in these orbital energy levels. Yeah.
Does every difference have a corresponding spectrum, you know, that it will absorb, given like a white light?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. And so that's why it's a fingerprint for the atom, because each atom has a different number of positive charges, sets up a different set of orbitals here, and literally gives you a different set of colors. All right, so the way this works, though, I'm just falling to pieces here. Okay, so the way this works is that if I have a photon coming in, the electron makes a transition from a lower energy level to a higher energy level, and that's absorption of light. If I have an electron up in a higher energy level and it cascades down to a lower energy level, it emits the photon. So when you saw the emission spectra, we had the gas and we excited the gas. That gas, literally what happens when we excite it with electric current, is the electrons get ejected from the atoms and then they cascaded back down. And as they cascade back down, it's not arbitrary. They actually cascade via these orbitals. And when they do, they emit light. And some of those particular light frequencies you could see as those discrete lines. So your intuition of the Bohr atom is light is absorbed like this and emitted like that. Okay? All right. Now, the problem is this picture is just wrong. I think it's good for intuition, but it's completely wrong in some other ways. And in particular, the picture of the electron orbiting in a circle and the mathematics that accompanies that, that I didn't drag you through, but it's literally exactly the same mathematics you would have if you had a rock on a string and did this around your head, or a planet around the solar system. That is classical mechanics, and it's purely classical Newtonian physics. It makes no sense with waves. Okay, and then we have de Broglie coming along and saying, well, we have these waves. And so people call this a semi-classical picture. The whole way it's cobbled together is really inconsistent. And actually, it would have probably been trashed by most physicists, except for it works really well. The Bohr model gives almost the exact colors that the hydrogen atom emits, for example. And more complex atoms, the Bohr model doesn't do so well. The Bohr model works really well if you have removed all the electrons except for one, but that only really works for hydrogen unless you, I mean, you can do that. So for single electron atoms, the Bohr model actually works pretty well. So it was a huge advance in understanding atomic spectra. But the problem is, it's sort of an inconsistent cobbled together picture. So once people realize that matter particles were waves, a theory needed to be constructed which started with that as the fundamental assumption, and the entire mechanics of the theory needed to be based on that. And that is what we actually mean when we say quantum mechanics. And it was developed in the 1920s and 30s. And two of the main players right at the start were Werner Heisenberg and Erwin Schrödinger. And so this is in the 1930s and 1920s that they did this work. So what this work was developing a theory that basically could solve for matter waves. And matter waves are a little different from electromagnetic waves. And so they had to actually come up with the mechanics of it. And this is the business equation. I'm not expecting you guys to get it, but it's just basically just so you've seen it, because it's a famous equation, Schrodinger's equation. And these guys both won the Nobel Prize for it. They developed very different ways of solving the problem mathematically that can be shown to be equivalent. Most of us in physics learn Schrodinger's system and rather than Heisenberg's, but they both made a lot of progress on it. So, well, I guess Wednesday we've got a test. I'm hoping that you won't be sitting here for the whole hour and 15 minutes or whatever, but I think I can't fill the rest of it with lectures, so if you're done, you're done. So we'll come back Monday, but what we're going to do is look at full-blown quantum mechanics and what it means when you try to analyze problems with this new revolutionary way of looking at things. And relativity was sort of bad, but with this, we're going to truly let the weirdness begin, because quantum mechanics is really strange stuff. So...